Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Deborah Harkness exploded onto the literary scene with her debut novel, A Discovery of Witches, book one of the magical All Souls trilogy, and an international publishing phenomenon. The novel introduced Diana Bishop, Oxford scholar and reluctant witch, and the handsome geneticist and vampire Matthew Claremont. Together, they found themselves at the center of a supernatural battle over an enchanted manuscript known as Ashmole 782. Now, picking up from A Discovery of Witches' cliffhanger ending, Shadow of Night plunges Diana and Matthew into Elizabethan London, a world of spies, subterfuge, and a coterie of Matthew's old friends, the mysterious School of Night that includes Christopher Marlowe and Walter Raleigh. Here, Diana must locate a witch to tutor her in magic. Matthew is forced to confront a past he thought he had put to rest, and the mystery of Ashmole 782 deepens. Deborah Harkness made her fiction debut with book one of the All Souls trilogy, which was a New York Times bestseller. A professor of history at the University of Southern California, she has received Fulbright, Guggenheim, and National Humanities Center fellowships. And it's a great pleasure to welcome her to The Book Show this morning. Deborah Harkness, thank you very much for being with us. A delight.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
I am interested in when you first set your eyes on this story, when you first thought about it, was it always your intention for it to be a trilogy, or did your imagination sort of get away with you?
It was always in my mind a story in three parts. I think at first I believed I would write a single book, part one, part two, part three. And when part one, I hit about the 400-page mark, I thought, okay, this, and I was halfway through part one, I thought, this is not going to be one book in three parts. It's going to have to be three books, or you're going to need a suitcase to carry it around with. So it was always in three parts.
And does that in some ways make it easier for you as the writer? I'm realizing there's probably nothing easy about this process, but that it's easier in the sense that you can explore, you have time, and you can include this rich history that you include and make these characters so real and vivid.
Yeah, I think, you know, people often complain about this new trend for books that are in trilogies and sets of four, but this is really a very old trend. It goes all the way back to ancient literature. You know, stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So whether it's in one book or in three books, this just has a good logical structure. And it really was just a byproduct of the fact that as part one got richer and richer in the telling, it just sort of necessitated having the second part in a second book and the third part in a third book. And it does allow me to really give the readers a journey, to give them an experience of reading that can sweep them into a different world.
What brought you to this world originally? What was the idea that said, okay, witches, vampires, and demons, we'll put them in with humans, stir, mix, and enjoy?
I think it has a lot to do with who I am actually as a scholar. As an undergraduate at Mount Holyoke College, I was really fascinated by how people imagine the world around them, how they told stories about it. That's what I've chosen to do as my career ever since, as a historian of science. That's really what historians of science do in very simple terms. We study views about the world, explanations of how the world works. And I was just so struck by the popularity of these otherworldly creatures, for lack of a better term, in modern popular fiction today. These shelves full of books of ghosts and vampires and witches and demons and fallen angels and you name it. And as a historian of science, it really made me think, okay, why do humans need this? Why do humans want this? And really, if these creatures are around, how does the whole world work? Not just the supernatural components of it, but how do those components fit with the human? And that's really from that set of questions is where the book came from.
So really from some very logical questions of why are we attracted to this stuff?
Why are we attracted to this stuff? And if those ideas are true, sort of as almost like I started with a logic problem, right? If there really are vampires, you know, what do they do for a living? How do they date? Where do they live? Why don't humans see them? Why don't we pay attention to them? What might explain that? So it was very practical, very pragmatic, very much about world building in the early stages of writing and developing the story.
And as a result, there is a lot of research. You have a lot of history in the books, as I mentioned. I would assume that's a delicate balance.
It is a delicate balance. I discovered in writing the second book, in writing Shadow of Night, that a little bit of research goes a very long way. As a historian, I know probably too much about some of the things that I'm writing about, and I had to get to the place where I saw the historical information and the research as a kind of spice, an accent to the story, because otherwise the story can just become completely submerged in a wealth of detail that I may find, you know, fascinating, but which would actually not do a whole lot for the reader and might actually detract from the arc of the story and the characters. So there was a lot of history, believe it or not, left on the cutting room floor when I was finished.
Do you want the reader to know where that line ends of what is true, of what actually happened, and what has been made up in this fictional world? Or do you want that line to be very blurry?
I think I'd like it to be blurry, in part because, as a historian, that line is blurry between what we know to be true and what we think is true and what may have happened but we can't absolutely prove. I have to handle those sorts of evidentiary problems all the time in my work. And I think sometimes standing on the outside, people think, well, historians know what happened. We think we know what happened. Sometimes we are 99% sure, but we can never fully know what happened in the past. So I like playing with that line and making the readers think, well, could it have been this way? Is that actually true? And then hopefully for some of them, they get intrigued and they look it up and they discover, yes, that part I thought was made up is true. And this part that I thought was actually true has been made up. So I do like playing with that.
In the second book, Shadow of Night, these characters are plunged into Elizabethan London. So let us begin there as the place of how exciting that is to explore.
Well, Elizabethan London is probably the place that I know best in a very strange way, in that that's really my period of history. Unlike Diana, I work in the 16th century, not the 17th century. So it's my home turf, in a sense. I wrote a book about Elizabethan London and the kind of scientific work that was done in the streets of the city during the reign of Elizabeth. So all of the historical dead ends and things that I maybe couldn't prove, or things that fascinated me, but there just wasn't the evidence to pursue them, I really was able to fold those into the story and imagine how those gaps might be filled. And that brought me an enormous amount of pleasure, and I hope will bring the readers pleasure as well.
There is that joy that comes. It seems it comes from the page of bringing these characters there, of visiting the past, that you very much enjoy.
Absolutely. Elizabethan London has got to be one of the most exciting places, one of the most exciting periods of history. It was such a diverse city. It was international and cosmopolitan in the makeup of its residents. There was enormous change going on culturally with the growth of theater, with the flourishing of the book trade in the city. And it was very, very compact. Elizabethan London was about 1 square mile. And yet so much happened there. So there was so much vitality and excitement and ingenuity on the city streets. And so those aspects of the past was what I really wanted to bring out in Shadow of Night, and give people a sense that maybe things in the past weren't so different from now. And yet, in other ways, Elizabethan London is really a very, very foreign country.
Deborah Harkness is our guest. The name of the book is Shadow of Night. When you look at the bringing the characters to this time and place, did you know that Sir Walter Raleigh and Christopher Marlowe are going to make an appearance?
Yes, I did, and it's all Matthew Royden's fault. When I was first coming up with the idea for the book and knew that I wanted the second part to be set in the past, because as a historian, I believe that the past can teach us something that the present cannot, and I wanted to dramatize that point. When I knew I was going to be setting Shadow of Night in the past, I knew that there was one character who lived in the past that I had always found fascinating and that I couldn't find out much about. And that was a very mysterious gentleman named Matthew Royden, who was always around much more well-known people. He was a friend with Walter Raleigh, with Christopher Marlowe. He was a spy. He was the best friend of Philip Sidney. He wrote poetry. And yet we don't even know when this man died. That was the real inspiration in some ways for the character of Matthew Claremont. It was actually Matthew Royden who helped to shape Matthew Claremont's character in book one of Discovery, because I knew that was who he was going to be when Diana and Matthew came to the past. So people say to me, oh, does he have to meet every famous person? And I say, well, I didn't make that part up, actually. That's the part that's actually true. These are the people that Matthew Royden truly knew. I was really circumscribed in my telling of Shadow of Night by the facts as we understand them about this mysterious man named Matthew Royden.
The character of Matthew is a geneticist. He is a vampire. I assume when you say, okay, this is the character, that there's great fun to be had with that, but there are also challenges and roadblocks along the way.
Absolutely. I think the great challenge with Matthew Claremont is that he is just so old. When I sort of blithely made him 1,500 years old and thought that would be great fun, I don't think I fully realized the enormity of what I was undertaking in terms of historical character development, the kinds of experiences that would have shaped him. And it is great fun, but it's also a great challenge to do it respectfully and responsibly. So I'm forever grateful for the fact that I always did think of it as a story in three parts, and that Matthew was always grounded sort of in the middle of his life in this Matthew Royden moment that I could then use to shape his interests, his beliefs, you know. So all, you know, the roads sort of go into Matthew Royden, this identity he assumes in Shadow of Night, and they come out of Matthew Royden in a very deliberate way. And I think that helps to make his character a little bit more logical and coherent for me as I created on the page.
We meet Matthew's father, Philippe, in this novel, and the story takes off at that point, doesn't it?
Yes, I think it does. Time travel, whenever, as a historian, I read it in books, is always seems that it's very smooth and seamless. There might be a few dramatic bumps in the road, but they're quickly overcome. And as a historian, I just felt like that wouldn't be Diana's experience. And so it's really when this dramatic moment happens in the story where Matthew is, for the first time, connects through correspondence with his father, his, in the present, dead father, and is forced to revisit a very painful loss in his own life, that I think the story really kind of gels and picks up and moves out of the getting to know Elizabethan London stage and into the full forward momentum of the plot. And Philippe is really instrumental in that, because he is someone who forces Matthew to face his own mortality and his own past.
And we learn so much of that backstory, which allows you to then just take off.
Right. And I think, you know, Matthew is a vampire, and in my worldview, vampires are very secretive creatures. And so he keeps an awful lot from this woman he is in love with. He's only been in love with her for 40 days when they arrive in 1590. So they haven't had a whole lot of a long amount of time to establish their relationship. So having Philippe able to push and prod Matthew and having Diana have to sort of get to know Matthew's family, Matthew's father, Matthew's past really, I think, helps to solidify their relationship and provides us with a lot of not only good historical backstory, but also emotional, kind of an emotional gravity to what's happening to them both individually and as a couple because of this new relationship.
We have talked about Matthew. Let us talk about Diana for a moment. The notion of making this character an historian like yourself, does that put you on familiar ground that is comfortable with? I mean, could you ever envision this character being anything else at this point?
I wanted always from the beginning to put the humanities and the sciences together. There's a big debate in our country about, you know, what is the relevance of the humanities? What is the relationship to the sciences? So I always wanted there to be a scientist and a humanist in the mix. I suppose Diana could have been some other kind of scholar, but I did make her a historian in part because a vampire would have to be irresistible to a historian. So this very reluctant witch is a very non-reluctant historian. She embraces her historical profession and she loves the past. So from that point of view, I kind of can't imagine Diana as anything else. But as for being on familiar ground, we're both historians, but she is actually a specialist in a later period than I work in. So it would be sort of like someone who works on World War II and someone who works on the American Civil War. What would they have in common? Well, they're both historians, but what they study is pretty distinct in terms of its time period. And that's a good thing for Diana not to be doing exactly what I'm doing.
The book is dedicated to Lacey Baldwin Smith, master storyteller and historian, who suggested some time ago that I should think about writing a novel. Given that you are a professor of history, When did you start thinking about writing a novel, and how do you balance the day job and the one that is now wildly successful?
Yes, well, I began to think about writing a novel in, you know, late September of 2008 when I actually started writing a novel. There was no real plan to do so before then. As for balancing it out, there are aspects of my job that are very similar. I feel like I am still a teacher. I just have a much larger classroom. I see students not only in the confines of the University of Southern California, where I'm still very pleased and proud to teach, but also in bookshops and on the web and on Facebook and other places. So really, you know, what my job is being an advocate for books and learning and literature and history. And I feel like I could do that both in my day job, so to speak, as a professor. But I'm also really pleased to be able to take that message to a wider audience in the form of the fiction, because it is very definitely, you know, a much wider cross-section of not only America, but the world than I even see in my very diverse classroom.
I've heard you make the point, and I think it's a fascinating one, that the kids that come into your classroom, say 18 to 21, 22 years old, have in many cases been brought up on Twilight and Harry Potter, and they come to you with this great love of reading and reading fiction and fantasy. You have called these books a bit of a stepping stone to some great literature that far precedes all of those other books.
Absolutely. I really did have my own students in mind when I wrote the first book, A Discovery of Witches, and when I wrote Shadow of Night as well. My students are enormous readers. They have grown up loving books. They're passionate about them. And we often say that the book is dead. Not in my classroom, it's not. These kids grew up with Harry Potter and with books like Twilight and other paranormal and fantasy stories. And then for many of them, they stop reading. And I want to try to write something where the hero and heroine would be in their 30s, so not in high school. So that would give them something to think forward about. I wanted to give them some pretty complex ideas about life and death and evolution and change and history and science, because that's my job as a professor, and put that in as well. And I also wanted to have them say to me, I love this book. What should I read next? And for me to be able to say, well, you should read Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose if you love the library parts. Or if you love the scholarly mystery, try A.S. Byatt's Possession, a wonderful book. And if you think, you know, vampire books started with Twilight, have you tried Anne Rice? You should really read Anne Rice. So I wanted to be able to use these books as a kind of springboard into an even wider range of books.
We touched on this, but do you have a sense, and even looking at that history of this of these genres, of why we as readers are so attracted to it?
Oh, Joe, I think if I could figure that out, I would be in very great demand in the publishing and entertainment industry. It is true that popular interest in these creatures is cyclical. Witches were very popular in the period that I study in the 16th century as an object of fascination. There was no mention of vampires in most of Western literature until the 18th century. You do get a kind of spiritualism revival in the 19th century. So there's an interesting way in which I think these otherworldly creatures are what I call monsters to think with. They tell us something about what we are worried about in our present moment, be it power or immortality or the environment or sex or money or whatever it might be. I think back to the 90s when I was reading Anne Rice as a student, and how very revealing I thought those books were about issues of power and money and privilege and sexuality, at a time when it was still a little difficult to take on what was kind of happening all around us in the late 80s and 90s. So I do think that people find them useful, and it's only in retrospect that historians and critics can look back and figure out exactly why we thought it was useful to think with vampires or witches at that moment. So to be continued. Some future historian will have a field day.
And now you're on tour, you're out and you're talking about the book, and I assume that you have to, knowing that there's a third one, that you have to have that pretty firm in your mind so that discussions and what people are speculating can't affect that in any way.
Yeah, it's absolutely true that I know where the story is going, and I don't. I try very hard not to let any of the speculation even enter my ears, never mind shape the story. So the third book is started. It's mapped out. I always knew from the moment I started writing A Discovery of Witches, I knew how book three was going to end, where the characters would end up. And that gives a shape to the whole trilogy, really, to know, again, the beginning, the middle, and the end is really crucial to an author in terms of structure. So I kind of listen to the speculation, but I do let it go in one ear and out the other, and probably 98% of it is completely wrong, as it passes through. So,
and that must make you feel good.
It does. There was great speculation about what would happen in book two when book one came out, and I thought, oh no, you have no idea what's going to happen. So one of the things that's always interesting to me as a writer is people will say, you know, well, I just don't understand why this happened in the book, because it's completely unnecessary to the plot. And I think, well, no, it's not, actually. It's just that you don't understand the significance of it yet, and you won't understand it until the next book. So having a really good sense of the plot all the way through the three books, having that template or outline is absolutely vital for me as an author.
Book two of the All Souls trilogy is out. It is Shadow of Night. It is published by Viking. Deborah Harkness, a great pleasure to have you with us on the book show this week.
It's always a pleasure, Joe. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, Deborah Harkness is the author of Shadow of Night. The book is published by Viking. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.